Hello, this is the European History Podcast. My name is Daniel. If you enjoy this series, please subscribe to our podcast, and you can like us on Facebook at the European History Podcast. And after this episode, if you have any questions or corrections for me, you can always email at theeuropeanhistorypodcast@gmail.com. The last episode, we talked about the rise of Greek civilization, the settlement of the mainland and Crete. And now we are going to go into this next part of the Greek discussion by talking about the expansion of the Greek world and the formation of colonies throughout the Mediterranean region. And then we'll do the second part in discussing the two major states and association of city-states, the Spartans and the Athenians. So let's get started. Around 750 BCE to 500 BCE, the Greeks expanded their territory, their wealth, and their contacts with other cultures through trade. Colonies began to be established across the Mediterranean, going from Spain to the Black Sea, so from west to east. Later, Greek colonial traders would set up outposts in Syria. They learned many new artistic and craft techniques from these older civilizations in Asia Minor. They also settled in the Macedonian region. They set up colonies in Italy, in Sicily, in the southern coast of France, the African coast. And the Roman people would describe this expansion of Greek culture and civilization and territory as the Magna Graecia. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but the Magna Graecia, which means the Great Greece or Greater Greece. So we have this spreading of Greek colonies. It was probably painful for Greek people. If you remember the last episode, we discussed the deep cultural connection of Greek people with the polis, with their home cities. So why would they do this? It was very dangerous at sea at this time. There's not a lot of safety. Navigation is limited. Technology, naval technology is limited. It's very risky to leave the polis. Nothing is guaranteed. You're leaving your people. So why is it happening? Why does this expansion of Greek civilization occur? The answer is going back to the agricultural factors in Greece. Only about 25% of the Greek mainland is good for farming. And with the limits of technology, only so much food can be produced in this land and per acre. So the Greek culture runs into the issue of overpopulation and food shortages. You just cannot have unlimited growth, unlimited economic and population growth in this territory. And so there really is no choice. So we have these colonies sponsored by the mother polis, these mother cities on mainland Greece. But this is not like, say, for example, American colonial history, where England and the Dutch and the French and the Spanish and the Portuguese established colonies really for the benefit of the mother country, which we call that we'll get to that, and that'll be called mercantilism. But these colonies, these ancient Greek colonies, were established specifically for the benefit of the colonists themselves. And the colonies will become very, you know, economically independent of their sponsor polis, their sponsor cities. When a colony became established, whether it was in southern France or in Spain, as we mentioned, land would be divided equally. And this kind of reflects a kind of egalitarianism among the people who took that risk to go out to a new place. There would be these partnerships between the mother city from mainland Greece and the new colony. And people in the new colonies, they would try to maintain those old traditions. They would worship the same special gods. They would have the same festivals. And the mother city and the colony would ask each other for help if they were in trouble. If there's a food shortage, if there's a military need, they could ask each other for help, even though it wasn't required. What we're going to see when we go into Athenian history is that this kind of familial colonial relationship between a mother city and the colony, this will be kind of be used by Athens when it enters its kind of imperial history. It'll be used as kind of a cover for what Athens is really doing with some of its neighbor city-states that it begins to economically, politically dominate. So it will kind of cover it with this kind of indication that they are in this family bond. But really, it's kind of more imperial control. So what was the benefit of Greek colonization? Well, it operated as a safety valve. Civil wars were avoided, and in comparison with new cultures, it acted as a mirror. Greeks who went out and formed colonies and started interacting with these other foreign unknown cultures, it kind of gave these Greek people a picture of themselves. They were able to see how they were different from these new cultures. And this kind of established and sparked and fostered what grew to be known as the Pan-Hellenic cultural spirit, this Pan-Hellenism. It's like this greater Greek identity. So also trade and industry was encouraged to be more intensive. Cash crops are being used. Things are being put to more practical and economic profitable use. These cash crops for olives and grapes for wine become popular. Pottery, tool making, weaponry, metalwork, and perfumes begin to be traded by the colonies with foreign cultures, other cultures, and also back and forth between the mother city and with the colony. This also began a socioeconomic reform, revolution, this movement. It began a social economic mobility for common workers and merchants and traders to become extremely wealthy, to become in some cases the most wealthy members of the polis. And that is all thanks to international intercultural trade. These new rich members of society will go on to challenge the aristocratic and non-democratic government traditions, even though they have this great wealth and this great social power, will still continue to be locked out of the political and government decision-making institutions in the mainland by the nobles, by the traditional aristocratic leaders. So now that we see this expansion of the Greek colonies and the pressures that were released, it also caused these socioeconomic changes that the Greek government political institutions had never really dealt with before. And this led to a reaction, and it led to these reactions known as the period of the tyrants between the years of 700 to 500 BCE. It was kind of like a political lockdown. It was a tyranny of a monarch who had power, but he had gained power and used power from very untraditional, unorthodox, not necessarily constitutional methods. But that's not to say that these tyrants were necessarily unethical or not necessarily unpopular. Many of them were very popular and did many things that are going to be historically very significant. A lot of times the tyrants or these tyrannical monarchs would have support from the hoplites, the soldiers that I talked about in the last episode, or sometimes from the politically disenfranchised, of either from the classes of the very new wealthy people or from poor farmers. Tyrants had a tendency to expel their noble opponents, and they would give, in many cases, the land of those nobles to their supporters. They often destroyed the privileges of nobles in the favor of the newly rich people. They also oversaw a period of great population growth. The tyrants encouraged the growth of city dwellers, urban growth. They instituted a program of public works, drainage systems, marketplaces, strengthening and expanding city walls, building and expanding religious temples and festivals, being patrons of the arts and artists and poets, to kind of increase the prestige of the tyrant's court. They supported artisans, and this all contributed to the great popularity of the tyrants. Of course, the period of the tyrants will come to an end around the 500s BCE. It will disappear mostly due to those excesses that come with absolute power. There's also this underbelly, this dark underbelly of repression and cruelty if you have movements against what the tyrant is trying to do. This also, fundamental problem of tyranny in these Greek polises is that the idea of tyranny is kind of antithetical to the polis itself, where everyone, every member of a polis was responsible. The members of the polis were like a family, and they owe justice to each other, and they are all creatures of tradition. And the tyrants really did not rule like that. They did not see themselves as beholden to anyone. They were not beholden to the traditions. They were not beholden to the identity of the polis. And so the idea of a tyrant becomes very kind of inimical to what a polis was supposed to be about. But nonetheless, tyrants gave massively significant contributions to Greek history and society. They encouraged technological innovation. They encouraged economic growth and trade. They reformed politics. They completely shattered and smashed the traditional grip on political and government leadership from the aristocracy. They encouraged urban renewal, urban growth. They encouraged the great expansion of the arts and literary achievements, etc. So we can't just dismiss this role of them. They're often very dynamic, very charismatic, very popular, and often mostly very ethical, making good reforms. It's just that they didn't operate from the traditions of the society. Okay, so that is our discussion of the expansion of Greek colonies and how, really, if we want to start to kind of, before we move on, if we want to kind of understand what's driving all of these changes I just went through, it's population growth and the reduction of a agricultural food surplus. As the food surplus goes away, you start seeing pressure. You start seeing pressure more than anything on the lower classes, people who are looking for something to eat, and you see changes. Things have to change when there is this kind of pressure. And so we see colonization. We see, with colonization, the huge increase in international trade, inter-civilization trade, which means a growth in technology, which means a growth in profitability, which means new wealthy people, not just the people who are wealthy from the power of their family and the history of their family. And so all of these changes lead to a lot of instability, political instability, and that is resolved with this period of tyrants who do make these changes. So let's talk about now the two major states, things that I'm sure everyone listening is somewhat familiar with, the two major states and their kind of spheres of influence. We have Sparta and we have Athens. And I hope that when we go through these two groups, you learn a few things and we talk about a few things that most people are not very familiar with. So we have Sparta and Athens, and they have, and this kind of gives us an example. I need to stop saying kind of, but we're going to need to look at how they give us an example of just how strikingly different the cultures among the city-states can be. In Sparta, let's start with Sparta. It is located on the Peloponnesus, which is the southern peninsula of mainland Greece. And around 725 BCE, again, population growth and food needs led to military conquest against the region of Messenia, which was to Sparta's west. The first Messenian War was won by the Spartans, and the Messenian people were turned into serfs. They were turned into what we call helots. And so this domination meant that Sparta had all of the land for food production that they would ever need. And also with the helots, the Messenians being turned into serfs, or basically slaves of the state, Spartans also didn't have to work. They didn't have to engage in agricultural labor. By 650 BCE, we see the Second Messenian War, which, as you could expect, was a rebellion by the Messenian helots with the help of other Peloponnesian city-states. This was a very long war, it was a very costly war, and it got to be almost an existential threat to the Spartan city-state. Sparta is able to put down the revolt, but it really, this is what changes Spartan society and turns Sparta into what I imagine you already think it is. But the Second Messenian War is what makes Sparta what it is. Sparta, as a result from this, becomes a military state. It becomes a military state in order to guarantee continued control over these helots, these slaves, and the Messenian territory. So what are these changes? The Second Messenian War, what changes come in Spartan society and traditions from this? Well, for one, every Spartan from birth starts to be controlled by the state. And not just from birth, and literally from birth, the state has the authority to decide which infants were fit to survive. So we can imagine that if an infant was judged to be handicapped or too small or had any kind of problem, either real or perceived, the infant would be killed. And this goes for boys and for girls. At age 7, the boys would go to instructors. They would not remain with the family. So immediately there we see kind of a deterioration or a subjugation of family devotion in favor of polis devotion, Spartan devotion. So at age 7, the boys go to instructors. They are trained in athletics and in the military arts. They are taught to endure and accept pain and suffering and to live off the country. Countryside, live off the land, even if that involves having to steal. At age 20, the males are enrolled in the army. They live in barracks with their peers until they are of the age of 30. They are allowed to marry, in a sense, but you don't live with your spouse, you don't live with your wife, and you would hardly visit each other, and you'd probably have to visit secretly. At age 30, the men would become full citizens and considered, you know, total equals in society. They could eat in a public mess hall with their peers of 15 friends or 15 comrades. They would be given a piece of land at age 30 that would be worked not by them, not by servants or paid laborers, but be worked by those helots. And that is nice, and this is what is driving this extreme change in Spartan society, extreme change. They're trying to maintain this, I guess in a way, easy lifestyle of not having to work and having control over this territory. It didn't involve much meat or wine production, and military service would still be required until the man reached the age of 60, at which time he could actually retire to his home and his family for the rest of his life. What about the women? Spartan women would, again, be judged at birth, whether they were fit. They would be trained in gymnastics. They had the freedom of movement, more freedom of movement than other Greeks, but they were indoctrinated mentally and educationally to be of service to the Spartan state, just like the men, in different ways, but the same ultimate goal. What, again, is this ultimate goal? What is making the Spartan people do this? They are changing the idea of family devotion to polis devotion, to Spartan devotion. And why are they doing this? It is to preserve this idea of controlling this territory to provide food and to control the Messenian helots. So these women are taught to sacrifice privacy. Men also are taught to sacrifice privacy, luxury, comfort, all for the purpose of the duty to the state, duty to the society as a whole. I find this very ironic because in reality, the Spartan way of life is lost. They give up. Sparta is not what it once was anymore. And so this seems very ironic to me. Sparta becomes obsessed with the preservation of this relatively new lifestyle of being served by the dominated, subjugated Messenians. But in any case, it has become so obsessive, it becomes so overwhelming that the pursuit of wealth becomes forbidden. The use of coin currency is forbidden. This is seen as a corruption of wealth, a distraction from what people should be really focused on in Sparta. And this gives the impression here, this is fascism. This is a proto-fascism. And I want to make sure when we think about that word, what I mean here is state worship, the state, total state domination of life, total commitment to the nation, to the community, instead of to your family, instead of to business, instead of other pursuits or ambitions. The glory of the state through military means, that is the fundamental concept of fascism. So here we see this example in European history for the first time, right here at the beginning. Let's talk about Spartan government. It was very odd, very complicated, very unique, very progressive in some ways. But Spartan government had a combination of monarchy with oligarchy and democracy. Just for information, the oligarchy is rule by a small group of people, usually wealthy, powerful people. So the monarchy consisted of two kings. Okay, so that's odd. That's unique right there. The two kings were limited by law, and they also, the power of the monarchies here is limited also because there is rivalry between competing wealthy houses, noble houses. The kings had religious and military functions. The Spartan army would almost never go out to battle without being led personally, literally, by one of the kings. So the kings are the military leaders and have religious purposes. The oligarchy form of Spartan government is shown in that they had a council of elders, which was 28 men. You had to be over the age of 60, and you were elected for life. This is oligarchic. This council of elders has judicial powers. They sat as a court in cases involving the king, and the council of elders had to be consulted on all proposals for the assembly. The Spartan assembly kind of shows you the democratic aspect of Spartan society. Yes, it wasn't just Athens that had democratic elements. We see this assembly here in Sparta also being somewhat democratic. The Spartan assembly involves all males over the age of 30. It was kind of democratic in a way, but like in Athens, only a small portion of the population of Sparta are considered to be citizens. You have to be a male Spartan over the age of 30. And it's also limited in the sense of being democratic in that most of the voting was by acclamation. And so really the Spartan assembly is just there to ratify the decisions of the council of elders or to choose between options that are being argued over by the nobles or the council of elders. So maybe give the tie-breaking vote between two choices to the assembly. But the assembly isn't necessarily going to be the place where legislation starts or proposals begin. They're just there to give their consent or to choose between pre-formulated options. Finally, in Spartan government, you see a board of ephors, which was basically instituted to review and check the power of the kings. But the control of the board of ephors will grow to actually control foreign policy, decisions on whether to declare war, to oversee the military leadership. They would chair the assembly meetings, and the board of ephors would have security and be in charge of keeping security over the helots. So we see in this Spartan government, you see these four different aspects. You see the monarchy of two kings, you see the council of elders with 28 members of basically senior citizens, and then you have the Spartan assembly where all the males over 30 get a vote or get participation, and then you have this fourth thing called the board of ephors. And so just by the very fact that you have a government where you have all of these different separate branches, each with powers that can check or limit or at least complement the other branches, we see this as a beginning of more limited government, as separate branches of checks and balances, etc. And these are going to be principles that are going to continue throughout in European history. They may expand and decline with different periods, but it will continue. In Sparta, it also gave me the idea of this city, if not proto-fascist, it's very cult-like. It is complete devotion. It's rejection of family. You're following this ideal model to become an ideal Spartan member, ideal Spartan woman, ideal Spartan man. Later in Spartan history, after this change, we see the development of what we have to discuss was called the Peloponnesian League. It was established in 550 BCE, and suppressing the Helots became an issue. It required the total effort of Sparta to keep these Helots under control. And that's odd because at the same time, they couldn't expand into new territories because of that, but at the same time, they can't allow their neighboring cities to grow and encourage Helot revolts and to challenge Sparta itself. So Sparta was able to defeat their neighbors at the end of the day. But again, with this constant problem of keeping the Helots under their thumb, they didn't have the manpower or the resources to actually subjugate new territories or their other city-states. So their solution was to leave these other city-states on the Peloponnesian Peninsula free, but in this kind of alliance, a forced alliance, where they had to follow Sparta in terms of foreign policy, and would have to supply a fixed number of soldiers on demand. This practice, this kind of domino effect of Spartan domination, grew to every city-state, with one exception, I think. And this began the Peloponnesian League. It's like this forced military alliance dominated by Sparta. So the Peloponnesian League grew in security and became the most powerful polis alliance. And yes, Sparta was more powerful than Athens in terms of military force, at least. We only know Athens better today, really, because of its legacy. The legacy of Athens and the democratic institutions and the cultural achievements that have survived, past Athenians. Great history. We remember Athens more, but in this time, Sparta is the dominant city-state in Greece, not Athens. We got to get that. That's probably something that is the biggest likely misconception with people who are thinking about Greek history. Okay, so that was the expansion of the Greek world. We talked about the Greek colonies, and we talked about the first of the major city-states, Sparta, the change of Sparta towards this fascistic or proto-fascistic society of giving everything to the city-state, and the development of the Peloponnesian League. Again, if you like this episode, please subscribe. You can like us on Facebook at the European History Podcast. If you have any questions, you can email me at theeuropeanhistorypodcast@gmail.com. This is Daniel. Join us next time.